Written, the strange man at my kitchen table says, let's play Manchurian, Cora. And I say, all right. And then something happens, but I don't remember what. Don't remember. Then he says, Auf Wiedersehen, you stupid skinny bitch. And all I say is, goodbye. As if he never insulted me. And then he's gone, as if he were never really there. But damn it, he was there. He was there. He was there. He was. The woman had laboriously copied that same passage 15 or 20 times, each repetition running into the next. In the stories of hers you've read, Jane said, does she ever use herself as a character?
No. Not herself, and not a Cora Smith or a Cora Jones.
So you believe this is something that happened to her?
I think it's one of the last things that happened to her. Because if this was her current journal, then those are the last words she ever wrote.
He riffled through the remaining pages to show Jane that they were blank.
What do you make of it?
There's one word that matters most, isn't there? She asked. Luther didn't at once reply. Decades of police work had surely taught him that successful investigations dealt with the world in its least fanciful interpretation, when the detective kept in mind that human motivations and the actions taken because of them were nearly always as predictable as the hours of sunset and dawn. He regarded stories of elaborate conspiracies as he would regard a claim of abduction by a flying saucer. The possibility that Cora was brainwashed and programmed must be, to Luther, sheer occult nonsense, and the supernatural had no place in a police investigation. Yet, if he had come this far, from Minnesota to Kentucky, he was a man of considerable intelligence, intellectually flexible in the best sense, aware that evil was real, not just one shade of gray on a spectrum of moral relativism. He also knew evil was industrious and unrelenting, always seeking new ways to express itself. Cora had left clues that led him down a path that he thought didn't exist, but he was too honest with himself to cling stubbornly to that view when he could see the path lying straight and clear before him. And so she pressed him by repeating the question. There's one word that matters most, isn't there?
Is there?
You know the book? The movie?
The Manchurian Candidate, by Richard Condon. But brains don't wash that easily.
The book was published way more than half a century ago. She took a sip of wine and put down the glass and met Luther's eyes and said, no one back then ever heard of nanotechnology. She saw that the term had full meaning for him, and his eyes widened enough so that she expected him to press her on the subject at once. Instead, he spoke even more softly.
Is Quantico really the ballbuster they say it is?
The FBI Academy was at Quantico, a U.S. Marine Corps base in Virginia. By referencing it, he meant to say that he intuited from where she graduated, but also that she was Jane Hawke. Didn't bust mine, she said. Chapter 13. With no sports talk, with no convivial conversations, with a clientele mostly of individuals rather than couples, none showing any intention of wanting to hook up with anyone else, the tavern offered a society of lone drinkers served by a bartender and two waitresses who seemed to have been infected by the cheerless nature of their customers. If not for the country music, the quiet was such that Jane and Luther might have been overheard, even if they had murmured. You knew me, in spite of the hair, eyes, glasses? Luther Tillman shook his head.
No. It was how you pumped the gallery manager, the waitress. A lot of what you wanted to know was what I wanted to know. Cora kills herself. Quinn Eubanks, sponsor of the conference here, he kills himself. They say your husband killed himself. David James Michael was associated with Eubanks. You asked the waitress about him. I've never seen media and government work together to demonize a fugitive to the extent they have you. I see them pull the FBI out of Cora's house, and a guy from the Justice Department threatens me. Only after I process all that, then I look closer at you and figure, yeah, I know her. A new tune swelled in the tavern. Wichita Lineman, sung by Glenn Campbell, full of longing and melancholy. Jane had always found the song as eerie as it was beautiful. As she surveyed the lone drinkers on their bar stools and at their tables, the music described their mood and inspired her to wonder about them. She looked at Luther. You have a family?
A wife. Two daughters.
Forget we met. Go back to Minnesota and just be with them.
That's not the way I am.
They threatened to kill my little boy and rape him first.
Did that make you back off?
I hid him away. Do it, Luther. Go home to Minnesota.
By doing that, what kind of world do I make for my girls?
At least it'll be a world where they still have you. He surveyed the tavern.
Are any of these people tourists?
My guess is they're all locals.
Is something wrong with this town?
Judging by appearances, nothing. Watching the uncharacteristically taciturn bartender draw an on-tap beer, Luther said,
What the waitress said. Freya. What kind of fever kills all the dogs just like that?
Jane set aside her half-empty wine glass. One that knows dogs aren't deceived by appearances.
What happened to the children? The school that doesn't have a name. Are those kids all locals?
Jane said nothing. Luther met her eyes again.
So, tell me what nanotechnology has to do with this.
I'll give you the 5-minute version. Believe it or don't. I won't waste time trying to persuade you what I know is true. After she told him about the brain implants, he set aside his warm, half-finished beer.
The terrorists in Philly, and everywhere.
No, they're just standard-issue ideological crazies, but they provide cover for what DJ Michael and these other bastards are doing. With terrorism unchecked, who notices the strange increase in suicides or thinks there's something unusual about someone like Cora going ballistic?
What is this town?
All over the country. Under many conditions, they've been injecting people. There's a high risk of being caught that way. She saw that he was chilled.
But pick a very small town and control everyone in it.
She said, a town with a resort to which the rich and powerful come, some of whom would never agree with the Arcadians.
The ones you can't persuade, he said, you take by force. You program them for suicide, or you just control them like puppets.
And you invite others who are or might become shapers of the culture, like Cora.
But these Arcadians, the Hamlet list, this is insanity.
Whole nations descend into insanity from time to time. Germany under Hitler, China under Mao. There's a long list of examples.
This Larkin tricked you here with a lie. But why would he want to give this away?
She scoped the other customers, who probably thought she and Luther were tourists. He figured I'd ask too many questions. When one of these people suspects me, he'll alert others. Then, what are the chances I get out of town alive? His voice a whisper.
Damn. Why aren't you gone already?
The kids on that estate, at that school. Why haven't they already been injected? He had no answer. It's not because the Arcadians have a soft spot for children, she said. It has to be
For some reason, they aren't old enough for the brain implant to work. Doesn't that have to be it? He studied her for a long moment.
And you're not getting out of Dodge until you can take them with you.
Every damn one of them.
How many are there?
Not many, judging by what I've seen.
When?
When do you think?
Not tonight.
Why not?
You have a plan?
Go in, get them, get out.
If the school's really a prison, they'll have security.
Some. She looked around at the patrons of the tavern, at faces forlorn and seemingly shaped by some deep misery beyond what usually drove drinkers to their cups. But how much fancy security do they think they need if every last person in this town is one of them? To imprison helpless children? Not much. I scoped the place. It's no Alcatraz. Chapter 14. At 7:30, Harley Higgins turned out the lights and sat in the dark by the window with a view of the estate grounds and took off his shoes and tucked them under his chair. He didn't know for sure if there were cameras in his room, but if there were, he didn't want to be seen leaving in his stocking feet. He should have thought to instruct the other kids to take this same precaution, but it hadn't occurred to him until now. He thought most of them would do as he had just done, but if only one were seen to leave his room shoeless, that might be enough to raise suspicion in whoever monitored the cameras, if anyone did. The lake lay as black as if it were not water, but instead a void. The woods along the lightless north shore were vaguely defined by a ragged dark line above which the cloud cover was a slightly lesser darkness. He kept thinking about his mom and dad. He wanted to believe that whatever had been done to them could be undone, which was a heart wish that his brain rejected. Heart wishes were a good thing if maybe they could be made real, if you could work hard to make them real. But heart wishes could become heartbreakers if you clung to them even when there was no hope they would come true. It was difficult to accept the likelihood that his parents were alive yet lost to him forever. So hard that he sat crying quietly in the dark. But to pretend otherwise would be to follow them into the community of others like them. He wanted his mom and dad, but he wouldn't become like them in order to be with them. The black lake lay beyond the window, moonless and deep, and a twin of the lake pooled within Harley, dark waters that could rise and chill and drown. The time was 7:45. Chapter 15. In her Ford, Jane drove out of town and toward the resort, with Luther Tillman behind her in his rental car. Dogless, child-free, awash in brood and bottle pleasantness, as pristine as a dreamscape, its industrial past having melted away, and its identity having been reforged into a vacationer's utopia, Iron Furnace fired in Jane a kind of fever, a burning conviction that she had been misdirected here by Larkin because this was now the womb from which would be born the change that he and his corrupt associates would impose upon the world. In this place, the dread with which she'd been living for months flared into fright that she needed to manage to avoid panic. This corner of Kentucky was an alien settlement, its people forever changed, enslaved. If they realized that she and Luther were aware of their condition, they might act with ruthless unanimity. These altered people could never be defeated by one rogue FBI agent and a single sheriff, because, by comparison, they were legion. If she or Luther made one misstep, the citizens of Iron Furnace might turn upon them like a school of piranha drawn to the blooded warmth of a mammal wading into their domain of cool water. She and Luther parked along the road, 100 yards past the walled estate that was said to be a nameless school, and approached the place on foot. Lacking a moon and stars in this overcast night, the lake and everything along its shores lay in obscurity.
"I'm not sure it'll work," Luther said.
"Neither am I."
"If it doesn't?"
"Take the staff down, hard."
"If they're not programmed after all, just innocent people."
"Whatever they are, they're not innocent."
"But if they are?"
"Then I go to hell instead of waiting for hell to come to me in this world. And it's coming faster every day." They left the road and tramped through wild grass and sedge, crushing underfoot something that gave off a faint licorice scent. Staying close to the estate wall, they walked past the house and toward the lake. Behind the house, they found a place where ancient ivy climbed the farther side of the masonry, draped the crown, and wove almost to the ground outside the property limits, a woody variety firmly anchored in mortar joints. As Jane ascended that random lattice in the gloom, clawing for handholds and toeholds, dead leaves crumbled and green leaves tore in her hands, the entire construct rustling, creaking. She reached the top and dropped 9 feet onto the estate grounds. No alarm sounded, nor did one announce Luther's arrival after her. Low-voltage, mushroom-capped lamps poured lucent pools on the stone pathways, and LED spots, nestled high in selected trees, spilled their radiance through labyrinths of branches, patterning the grass with light and shadow, while in the distance an illumined gazebo appeared strange, compelling, as if it were a shrine. No bright security lights were activated to complement the decorative lighting, and darkness remained predominant under the vault of night. Jane moved toward the house, with Luther at her side. Chapter 16. In his stocking feet, Harley left his dark room and moved warily along the hallway in the north wing of the house. He followed the connecting hall to the south wing, and from there proceeded to the main staircase. At this hour, the front stairs were less risky than the back, which opened into a mudroom. Adjacent to the mudroom lay the kitchen, where dinner for the staff was being prepared and was about to be served. The broad limestone treads curved gracefully down past an elaborate crystal chandelier to a foyer. Having descended halfway, Harley heard footsteps and froze. He watched as one of the staff, Walter, came out of the living room and crossed the foyer, stepping on luminous prismatic shapes cast down by pendant crystals. Without glancing up, Walter quickly disappeared into the connecting hallway between the south and north wings. This was Harley's one and only chance to escape untrackable. If they discovered he had learned the secret of the shoes, the next GPS locator would be irremovable, maybe surgically implanted. Therefore, he hesitated only a moment before hurrying down the remaining steps and crossing the foyer to the library, which lay opposite the living room archway. He cautiously opened the door, saw no one, stepped inside, and closed the door behind him. He thought he was the first to arrive. Nora Reinhardt rose from behind a wingback leather armchair, 3 times her size, and stage whispered, "It's Harley." Whereupon little Sally Ingram pressed aside a floor-length brocade drapery and stepped into sight. The time was 7:54. Chapter 17. At a door on the west side of the house, Luther held Jane's penlight, the beam focused on the escutcheon, in which the deadbolt cylinder was positioned a few inches above the knob. She had tried the door and found it locked. Before leaving her car, she'd tethered her Lock-Aid lock-release gun securely to her belt. Now she inserted the automatic pick into the keyway and repeatedly triggered the device until the lock relented. If she had made the right assumptions based on what she knew and on what Luther had revealed in the tavern, She had no need to worry about a security system. One might exist, and it might be set, but if she triggered it, the alarm would do nothing but bring staff to her, which would save her the time of finding them. When she opened the door, no siren sounded. If this violation of the premises had been detected, the workers had been notified by some silent signifier, perhaps by flashing lights in key rooms. She stepped inside and found a light switch and flipped it as Luther entered behind her and eased the door shut. They were in a combination bedroom and sitting room that perhaps housed one of the staff. Considering its direct entrance from outside, it had most likely been a maid's quarters when the house was a residence rather than a prison. An open door revealed an adjoining bathroom. The neatly made bed, the cleanliness, the absence of clutter, and a certain air of sterility felt more easily than described, made this studio apartment of a piece with every place that she had seen in Iron Furnace. They moved toward an inner door, beyond which might be a hallway. The door opened as they reached it. A beefy, florid-faced man in a white uniform halted on the threshold.
"Who are you?"
Chapter 18. At one time, the library must have contained books. Now, several hundred feet of walnut shelving were dust-free and polished, though bookless. No fragrance of aging paper scented the air, and neither newspapers nor magazines awaited reading on the marquetry table in the center of this grand space. When the door opened, Harley stiffened with apprehension, but three more arrivals brought their number to six. Dulciana Moss and Jenny Boone entered first, and Bobby Acuff followed, closing the door with exaggerated care, as if the faintest click would bring a pack of hellhounds down on them. During their first month or two in this joint, Jennifer Boone had been constantly in tears, homesick, and anguished that her mother had consigned her to imprisonment with no explanation other than, "It's for the best." When she had no more tears, Jenny began to toughen herself, as if preparing to fight her way free of this so-called school and through the town to someplace still sane. She had been soft and slow, but after long months of exercise, she'd grown hard-muscled and quick. Once pale, now tanned. Her previously brown hair was streaked with blonde that even winter sun, taken in excess, granted her. Jenny's sorrow had given way to anger, and in time to a steely determination. Dulciana Moss, 11, chubby on arrival, loomed thin and pale-lipped and shallow-eyed. At first talkative and unconcerned about being shorn from her family, certain they would return for her in a few days, she gradually used up most of a lifetime's allotment of words. Until now she spoke succinctly and only when necessary. A daughter of atheists, these days Dulciana saved her words mostly for God, because though he never answered her, he hadn't yet betrayed her, as those who didn't believe in him had betrayed her. Bobby Acuff, the same age as Harley, took refuge in expectation of more imminent horrors than the one awaiting them in 2 years. With every storm, he anticipated a catastrophic flood, as well as lightning that would cleave him as it had once split an oak tree in his family's yard. Every wind was a potential tornado that would spin them to oblivion, every spider bite and bee sting a lethal wound from which he was routinely amazed to recover. The day they had been brought here by their parents, Bobby had seen his 4-year-old sister, Ramona, die at the front steps of the portico. Ramona screamed and wept and threw a tantrum, resisting abandonment, so that their frustrated father tried to shake some sense into her. Tried too hard. Maybe she suffered multiple concussions from the violent shaking, her brain rebounding from the concave surface of her skull. Maybe an artery burst. She went limp in her father's hands, collapsed onto the pavement, nose issuing a rush of blood that quickly waned. Bobby's mother and father were devastated. Briefly. Recovering as efficiently as only the changed people could recover, as if grief were a fine milled dust that a faint breeze could disperse, they left Ramona dead upon the pavement and drove away. Staff buried her in at the north end of the estate, sans coffin, on a bed of powdered lime, blanketed in more lime. Sometimes, Harley wondered how many other kids resisted and were mortally, if accidentally, injured. The time was 7:59. Chapter 19. In answer to the florid-faced man's demand to know who they were, Jane said, "Play Manchurian with me," as Cora Gunderson had written with obsessive repetition.
"All right," he said.
And with those words, all the tension went out of him. He stood in the doorway, regarding Jane with the patient curiosity of a weary dog, waiting for his master to tell him whether the time had come to move from hearth to bed. "What's your name?" she asked.
"Seth Donner."
"Come in, Seth. Sit down." He went to the chair that she indicated and sat and cocked his burly head, as though concerned that he not miss hearing what might next be required of him. His eyes were like the glass orbs of some ventriloquist's companion, as pellucid as 1 inch of fresh-drawn water. Not by way of blasphemy, but as though with the intention of succinct prayer, Luther whispered, "Jesus." "Seth," Jane said, "how many others are on the staff?"
"Seven. Seven others on the staff."
"Eight, including you?"
"Yes."
"Where are the seven?" Seth seemed to listen to a voice they couldn't hear, then said,
"They're in the kitchen and dining room. It's almost dinner time."
"Are the children there?"
"No. Staff only."
"Where are the children?"
"In their rooms, upstairs."
"How can you be sure?"
"I'm aware of their locators."
"Locators? What locators?"
"The locators in their shoes."
"Aware of them how?" He frowned.
"I'm aware of their locators at all times, ever since the upgrade."
"Upgrade? What do you mean, upgrade?"
"Last December."
"What was upgraded?"
"Well, you know, upgraded."
Mystified, she let it go. "How many children are here?"
"Eight."
"One of you for each child?"
"Yes."
His arms were limp, hands in his lap, one upturned as if he'd been holding something so light that it floated off his palm and away. Though grateful for the man's pliancy, Jane was also distressed by it, half nauseated. Grilling a bad and dangerous man while he was bound to a chair and at her mercy didn't make her feel unclean, but she felt soiled now, as if any interrogation that lacked struggle and resistance must also be without virtue. She and Luther exchanged glances, and he didn't need to express his abhorrence for her to be aware of it. "Seth," she said, "you will forget this conversation. Forget that you ever encountered us."
"Yes."
"You will sit here until I release you with the right words. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
She drew the pistol from her shoulder rig and Luther drew his. She followed the sheriff into the hall, pausing at the threshold to look back into the room. Seth Donner had not turned his head to follow them. He gazed up at the place Jane's face had occupied, as if she had been a divine manifestation from whom he would await a second visitation, rapt and adoring, even through thirst and starvation. Chapter 20. Tom Proctor, 12 and thoroughly reliable, slipped into the library at 8:02, bringing with him Jimmy Cole, about whom Harley had been worried. Physically and emotionally fragile since day one, thin and pale to start, fading ever since, Jimmy had been the one most likely to forget the rendezvous, or, if he came, to show up wearing the shoes he had been told to leave behind. Responsible Tom thought to look after him, and now the eight of them were gathered. Harley said,
"We're going through that door over there, into the study, then along the service hall to the laundry, and into the garage. I'm going to drive us out of here in the Escalade."
"You can drive?" asked Jenny Boone.
"I can drive enough."
Bobby Acuff, always cognizant of the potential for calamity, said,
"You don't have keys. We're going nowhere without keys. We're beat already."
"I know where they keep the keys," Harley said.
Chapter 21. The kitchen, redolent of roast chicken, of the fragrant steam rising from pots containing vegetables cooked in chicken broth, the hum of the oven fan, and the susurrant rush of that warm air through the vent grill. A woman at the cooktop, her back to Jane and Luther, and a man standing at the dinette table, sliding dinner rolls from a tipped baking sheet into a serving basket. Jane said, "Play Manchurian with me." The man looked up, and the woman turned, and simultaneously they said, "All right." "Sit at the table." In the act of stirring something, the woman took a long-handled spoon from a pot and put it on the counter, and the man put down the baking sheet, and they sat, as instructed. "Stay here and wait for me," Jane said. And they agreed. And she crossed the room to join Luther, who had already pressed open the door to the butler's pantry. She followed him through another door, into the dining room, where four staff members, dressed all in white as if they were consecrated in some cult of virgins, sat ready to eat at the table, while a man, also attired in white, poured ice water from a clear glass pitcher jeweled with condensation.
"Play Manchurian with me," Luther said on entrance.
The four at the table turned their heads toward him and chorused,
"All right."
But the man with the pitcher might have been distracted or perhaps a bit hard of hearing. He reacted not to Luther's control command, but rather to the turning of the others' heads, looking up in surprise and pouring water past the aimed-for drinking glasses onto a silver caddy that held shakers of salt, pepper, and other spices. He saw their weapons, shouted a warning, dropped the pitcher, and pivoted away from the seated four as shattered glass and crescents of ice glimmered across the tablecloth, borne on spilled water. The fleeing man reached the archway before Jane called out, "Play Manchurian with me!" Although the quartet at the table repeated their assent, she didn't know if the fifth had heard her until she pursued him and found him standing in the hall, as though he had forgotten where he was going and why he had dashed from the dining room. His gaze conveyed confusion and fear, and a sense that he was lost. His hands were fisted at his sides, the knuckles as sharp and white as if skin had split to reveal bone. The torment in his eyes moved her, though not to pity, which was for the distress and misfortune of others that one didn't share. Instead, sharp sympathy pierced her, for he had been robbed of his dignity by the people who would steal hers at the first opportunity. He had been shaken out of the life he'd been meant to live, and into a life shaped for him, not unlike how she'd been reduced from a hunter of fugitives to a fugitive herself, from wife to widow, from being a mother every day to being a mother as events allowed. She holstered the pistol. "I'm not here to hurt you. Do you believe me?"
"Yes. Of course. Yes."
"What's your name?"
"George."
"Don't be afraid, George. Not of me." He seemed to seek answers in her eyes.
"What's happened to me?"
"Don't you know, George?"
"Something's happened. What was? isn't.
Nothing could be done for him. Slaves shackled could be freed by the cutting of chains, by the passage of laws. But the nano-web spun across the surface of his brain, its fibers woven deep into his gray matter, allowing no casting off of chains, and could not be undone by even a law of the best intentions. "Don't be afraid," she repeated, and though it sounded foolish, it was the only thing she could think to tell him.
"Are you afraid?" he asked.
"No," Jane lied.
"All right, then."
His fists relaxed.
"All right.
Come back into the dining room, George. Sit down with the others." With lamb-like docility, he did as she told him, but she felt none of the worthiness of a good shepherd. Chapter 22. The garage was paved with all but impervious quartzite and offered spaces for 12 vehicles, though only 4 were assigned to the live-in staff of the fake school. The northwest corner was occupied by an open workshop with built-in cabinets, workbench, and all kinds of tools racked on perf board, everything clean and neat. The garage was off-limits to the kids, but Harley had been there a few times. The staff couldn't do anything worse to him than what they had already done to him by imprisoning him. Their punishments didn't matter to him. No dessert for dinner, stupid things like that. Until last December, he had been able to spend time here. But then something had changed. Now, they seemed to know the moment he stepped into the garage, and they came right away to get him. The previous November, he'd hidden in the Cadillac Escalade, hoping someone would drive it out, not knowing he was lying in the cargo area behind the back seat. From that vantage point, he had raised his head to watch Noreen return from town in the Ford Explorer. She had unlocked one of the drawers that flanked the workbench and put the Ford key in there and locked it away. Now, in their stocking feet, the 8 inmates gathered in front of the workbench. Although the cabinets were well constructed, Harley believed he could quickly force the lock. From the array of tools, he selected a claw hammer and a screwdriver.
"No! No! They'll hear!" Bobby Acuff fretted. "They'll hear! And they'll come! And they'll kill us all!"
"They're at dinner on the other side of the house," Harley said. "The way I'm going to do it, they won't hear."
"They can hear as good as dogs," Bobby Acuff said. "They hear stuff other people can't hear. They hear everything."
"Oh, please, Bobby, stick a sock in it," said Jenny Boone.
"Even if they hear, the most they'll do is not give you any cake with dinner tomorrow."
"No, they'll kill us all," Bobby insisted. "Just because they haven't killed us until now doesn't mean they won't kill us when they want to."
Chapter 23. Intuition was the highest form of knowledge, antecedent to all teaching, not reliant on reasoning. Jane had great respect for this inborn wisdom, as it had saved her life on several occasions. She intuited now that things were not going as well as they seemed to be, that a threat impended, soon to blindside them. On the second floor, she and Luther hurried along the south hall, throwing open doors, searching room to room. Some spaces were unfurnished. There were also suites, in which children obviously lived, but in which they could not at the moment be found. In the third suite, Jane saw something that halted her. A pair of sneakers by the side of a bed. Luther stepped out of the bathroom.
"Nobody here."
"Are there shoes in the closet?" she asked. He pulled open that door, switched on the light, leaned across the threshold.
"Clothes, but no shoes."
"Where are the children?" Jane had asked Seth Donner. "In their rooms, upstairs." "How can you be sure?" "I'm aware of their locators." "Locators? What locators?" "The locators in their shoes." She remembered a pair of sneakers in the first furnished suite. They had been left beside an armchair. And in one of the other suites, a pair had stood by the bathtub. In the hallway, Luther opened a door and said, "Not furnished." And Jane went past him to the next suite, where a pair of sneakers stood to one side of the door, as if they had been taken off just before the kid departed. "They're making a break for it," she said, "if they haven't broken out already." As she ran toward the stairs, intuition hounded her. Some great peril was almost upon them, but she didn't know what it would be or from where it would come. She remembered something else Seth Donner had said. Ever since the upgrade. Chapter 24. With his tongue between his teeth, Harley Higgins focused intently on the job. The screwdriver, the blade of which was inserted between drawer front and cabinet face, featured a rubber-coated handle so that the hammer striking it produced little sound. The risk lay in the hard crack of wood splintering and the screech of the lock parts as they strained against one another. Bobby Acuff predicted catastrophe every 10 seconds, and Jenny Boone said, "Acuff, get your head right, or I'll kick your ass up to your shoulders, so you'll have to take off your shirt to crap." Bump of hammer driving the screwdriver blade like a chisel. Bump, bump. Dry wood splitting, old brass parts shearing. Lock and wood parted, and the drawer came open to reveal a metal box. Harley took the box from the drawer and put it on the workbench and opened the lid. Electronic keys for the four vehicles. Just then, the connecting door to the house opened, and two people he didn't know came into the garage. Bobby Acuff let out a thin cry of despair, but Harley had a sudden good feeling. One of the strangers was an old black guy. He must have been 50. Geez, maybe even older. But he was big, and you could tell he was tough in spite of his age. There was a girl, too. She looked as though she'd stepped out of a Victoria's Secret catalog, except for what she was wearing. But somehow, you could tell that she and the black guy came from the same place, were in the same business, neither of them being people who took any shit. Chapter 25. In their fear, in their postures of dreadful expectation, the kids would have broken Jane's heart if she'd had time for the more tender emotions. Even the biggest of them seemed terribly small, vulnerable, and their faces revealed that they were wounded souls. She told them the half-lie that she was FBI, and Luther told them the truth that he was a sheriff, and the kids were desperate enough to believe them without hesitation. "We're taking you out of here," she promised. A boy of about 14 held up an electronic key. "We can use the Escalade."
"No," Luther said. "We'll use one of their remotes to open the main gate, but if we take their vehicles, they'll be on us like flies on sugar. We've got two cars. We can just about fit all of you in them."
"We don't have shoes," one of the girls reported.
"Yes, we know why," Jane said. "We've got to get on the road. We'll buy shoes tomorrow." From outside, beyond the garage door, came the sound of engines in the driveway and the bark of brakes. More than one vehicle. "I'll go look," she told Luther, and hurried into the house. At the front of the residence, she made her way through the dark living room by the faint inspill of light from the foyer. She pulled aside a drapery and saw half a dozen vehicles in the long driveway, cars and SUVs, the drivers just now dousing the headlights on the most recent arrivals. Someone had been able to open the huge bronze gate. Another car pulled in from the county road and stopped, and the headlights went off. People were getting out of the vehicles, men and women, but mostly men. At least a dozen. To get here this fast, they must have come from the nearby resort. But in response to what call? No one approached the door. They stood under the portico roof and arrayed along the driveway. Murky figures lit little and low and at odd angles by the landscape lamps. more human shapes than human beings, their faces veiled in shadows. They were not restless, but stood like witnesses to some forthcoming and meaningful event to which they would one day testify. They didn't appear to talk to one another, as if they knew why they were here and what they must do. Jane suspected they were waiting for others who were en route from a greater distance, from the town of Iron Furnace, where it was Christmas all year long. Although she stood in darkness, she sensed that some of these unwanted visitors were aware of her and staring at her. She let the drapery fall into place and hurried through the ground floor to Seth Donner's room. He hulked on the chair in which she'd left him, but he no longer stared at the vacant air where her face had once been. He stared instead at his hands, resting together on one thigh. Nothing of his mood or thoughts could be discerned in his slack features. "Seth, are you with me?" The big man raised his head, and his gaze had no terminus, as if he looked through her to infinity. His eyes were intact, yet he seemed as blind as eyeless Samson brought to his death in Gaza.
"Yeah, I'm with you."
"Earlier you mentioned the locators in the kid's shoes. You said you're aware of them at all times."
"The kids are in their rooms now. Every one of them."
"You said you've known where the children are at all times, ever since your upgrade."
"At all times. Since December," he confirmed.
"What upgrade are you talking about, Seth?" He frowned.
"Well, you know, the upgrade."
"What do you mean by upgrade?" His frown deepened, and he didn't respond. "Play Manchurian with me, Seth."
"All right."
"You said you always know where the kids are because of their locators."
"We all know. We don't need to track them with an app anymore."
"You once tracked them on smartphones?"
"Not anymore."
"So how do you track them now?"
"They display."
"The locators display? Where do they display, Seth?" He looked perplexed.
"They just display."
In the abandoned factory, before Randall Larkin rushed her and forced her to kill him, his face had shaped into an arrogant sneer, and he had gloated,
"You're dead already, you piece of shit. They'll all know about you in the Whispering Room."
"Seth, what is the Whispering Room?"
"It's just a room where we go."
"A room in this house?" He thought about it before he said,
"No."
"Where is the Whispering Room, Seth?" He raised one hand and tapped his forehead, which beetled over his deep-set eyes.
"I guess it's here somewhere. I never really think about it. It's just here somewhere."
She was fitting it together piece by piece, and she didn't like the picture that was forming. The great house remained quiet, no windows shattering, no doors being broken down. Not yet. "Is there something other than GPS displays in the listening room, Seth? Do you hear any voices there?"
"Sometimes a voice. Just whispering real low."
"Whose voice?" He shrugged.
"Anyone's."
"Do you ever whisper in the Whispering Room, Seth?"
"A few times."
"Who do you whisper to?"
"Everyone."
Her heart knocked, each beat as if struck from the taut skin of an aboriginal drum, summoning her deepest and most primitive fears. "Everyone in Iron Furnace, they hear what you whisper?"
"Yeah, they all hear."
An upgrade to the nanotech control mechanism in their heads, a feature that linked them all through microwave transmissions. They were no longer 600 controlled individuals. They were that and more. They were a hive. She thought of George, pouring water in the dining room. He had failed to hear the control command when Luther first spoke it, and he had attempted to flee. She'd called out to him and caught up with him in the hallway. During those seconds between when he had seen them with their weapons drawn and when he had come under her control in the hall, what had George said in the whispering room? At the least, he must have called for help. Seth, do you still have a smartphone?
Yeah.
What's the number? He gave it to her, and she repeated it several times until she felt that she would remember it. Do you have your phone with you, Seth? When he produced it from a pocket of his uniform jacket, she said, Is it turned on? No? Then please, turn it on now. Okay. Good. Leave the phone on and wait here, Seth. I'll call you before too long.
All right.
Her knees felt loose, her muscles slack, but they carried her at a run to the garage. Chapter 26. Jane at the head of the procession, Luther at the back, their pistols drawn. The children, two by two, between them. Nothing to be done but brazen it through on foot. They could only hope that Cora Gunderson had given them all they would need, that what had worked thus far would work for a few minutes longer. She used a remote control that had been clipped to the visor of the Cadillac Escalade. The segmented garage door clattered upward in its tracks. A 30-foot length of pavement led to the southeast corner of the big house and connected to the circular drive in front. In those 30 feet stood 15 to 20 people, all facing the garage, silent here, if not in the whispering room they shared. Low pathway lamps splayed arcs of pale light across the feet of this tense assemblage, but they were otherwise darksome figures and ghastly in their watchful stillness, like inhabitants of pandemonium ascended from subterranean streets of burning tar, waiting for the commanding note of some infernal horn before seizing a quota of innocent souls to be borne down into the final abyss. When Jane led the children out of the garage, the hive members moved toward her, and she raised her voice to halt them. Play Manchurian with me. She feared they would be immune to this manipulation, but they responded with the unanimity of a congregation during a litany. All right. And halted in anticipation of her next words. Move aside, she said, and let us pass. Most obeyed at once, though a few briefly hesitated before complying. Let us pass and wait as you are. As Jane led the children and counted on Luther to have her back, she came close to some of those over whom she had asserted control. Their faces clarified slightly out of the shadows, like the visages haunting a séance mirror in the murky, candle-lit parlor of a medium, eyes colorless and darkly glistening and as whiteless as the eyes of insects, for the most part conveying less emotion than death masks. Here and there, a twitch or a squint, or the baring of clenched teeth, suggesting inner conflict, perhaps because they had answered a call to arms only to be disarmed with a few words. But even these remained obedient to the game master who asked them to play Manchurian. Turning the corner of the house, Jane almost faltered at the sight of at least 50 people gathered on the driveway, under the portico, and on the lawn, blocking exit. On first sight of the children, they moved forward in silence with unmistakable intent. Jane raised her voice and issued the invitation to the game as a command, and it seemed that she was answered submissively by all. However, one among the stilled swarm continued to approach slowly, solemnly. The woman might have been in her late 30s, blonde hair ashy silver in the poor light, one hand raised to her breast as though to quiet a pounding heart. No evil individuals stood sentinel here. These people lived constricted lives, unaware of their enslavement, believing they were free. Perhaps they could be made to do cruel things with no memory of having done them, but Jane wanted to avoid stopping them with bullets, if words would suffice. Nevertheless, when she commanded the approaching blonde to halt and was not obeyed, she raised her pistol in a two-hand grip and warned the children, "Kids, look away. Look down, now." The blonde halted, about 2 feet from the muzzle of the pistol that centered on her pretty but eerily blank face. She opened her mouth and shaped words, though no sound at first issued from her. On her second try, she said, "All right," acknowledging her powerless condition. However, her eyes fixed on Jane's, and clearly she wanted to say something more. The hand pressed to her breast drifted away from her, as if it must be suddenly weightless, less in the woman's control than freed from gravity and floating under the influence of what few electrons and protons of solar wind might be present even in the night. Before the woman dared to reach for the pistol, Jane said, "Move aside, now. Move aside, and let us pass." The seemingly ungoverned hand drifted slowly back to the woman's breast, and then lowered to her side. She stepped out of their way. One of the two children immediately behind Jane, the boy named Harley, spoke then, his voice trembling.
"Mom? Mom? Mommy?"
And the blonde turned her eyes to him. Chapter 27. Seeing his mother come out of the night, out of the crowd, Harley thought that everything might not be lost, that their lives could be put right again. This was the first time he'd seen her since the day, 10 months earlier, when she and his father brought him to this so-called school. Maybe life could be like a sci-fi movie after all, and maybe this FBI agent and this sheriff would have the power to undo even the work of evil ETs, or whatever other power had changed people. His resentment and sorrow lifted from him, and he spoke to her. She looked down at him, and he saw that she knew him. Her eyes were shadowed and her face without expression at first, but he felt that somewhere deep inside her she remained who she'd always been, still his mother, good and kind and gentle and loving. Again he spoke to her, and she reached out to him, her hand upturned that he might place his in it, in this hand that had once tousled his hair and felt his forehead for fever and straightened his necktie when he wore his Sunday best. He heard himself say he loved her, which he did, and always would. As he raised his attention from her hand, he saw her blank face forming an expression, though not one that he'd ever seen on her before. Not one suitable to a mother and child reunion. It was a needful look, but a fierce, twisted need. And though she smiled, the smile was one of triumph rather than affection. As if whatever used her now couldn't avoid expressing its feelings through her as it shaped her features to deceive. Their fingers touched, and her reaching hand became a claw that seized him. He tore loose and shrank from her, and the FBI lady told her to step back. His mother, not his mother, but a mother thing, did as ordered, her face again without expression. Harley heard himself make a terrible sound, and he told himself not to make another like it. Nothing had been lost here. He had told himself for many months that there could be no going back, that all this strangeness washed away any chance of a return to normalcy. But if nothing had been taken from him this night, he nevertheless felt as though he had lost his mother all over again, and he regretted allowing himself to hope. The FBI lady said, "Harley, sweetheart, you'll be okay. You hear me? I promise you'll be okay. Take Jenny's hand."
She wasn't smiling, exactly, but there was kindness in her face that he had hoped to see in his mother's. Jenny, you take Harley's hand. Help each other.